This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, a monthly show devoted to the creative life. This month I have an interview with Catherine Carter of Catherine T. Carter Associates and a short interview with Harold Hansen, who passed away a few weeks ago, an antiques dealer in Hudson, much loved and respected. Following that, J.S. Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor in Harold's honor. This is Richard Roth, and I'm here with Catherine T. Carter of Catherine T. Carter and Associates, a firm which specializes in public relations and career advice for artists. Is that accurate, Catherine?
Yes, I think it's accurate. We are also a marketing firm. We do a lot of research for our clients and try to find the best exhibition venues nationally to exhibit their work.
How long have you been based in, I know that you live in Kinderhook, and I guess that's where you work from. Have you been here a long time?
Well, I moved to Kinderhook in 2005, and I came from Florida. Prior to being in Florida for 12 years, I had been up north since 1978.
And you actually began your career as an artist.
That's correct, I did. I had quite a lot of success early on in my career. And I was actually in an automobile accident and lost the use of my arms. And it went on for quite a number of years. And finally, I just accepted the fact that I was going to have to make a career change. And so I started helping artists.
Had you been collecting art all those years? Had you always
yes.
been interested in collecting?
Oh, yes. That's one of the great sort of perks of what I do. You're able to amass a wonderful art collection.
And having been to your place, I know that you have a massive art collection.
I know. It's like I think I'm going to have to start rotating things in and out of the basement.
And you also have quite wide-ranging tastes in art.
Yes, I do. I've always sort of had a very democratic approach to, how I approach my business, how I work with artists. I think my job as a public relations and marketing specialist is to be able to sort of have a clear idea in my mind as to where an artist might fit within the national nonprofit area. And we sort of have a broad way of interpreting that, from more traditional contemporary art museums to natural history, science museums, zoos. It's a very, very broad spectrum, and a lot of opportunities exist nationally.
And I believe I heard you say that you may approach several hundred venues for an artist.
Well, over the course of an 18-month contract, we will probably contact between about 300 and 450 venues on behalf of our clients.
And that's venues of all those various kinds could be involved.
Well, I guess if I were going to just define it, it would be museums on college and university campuses, better college and university art galleries, art centers, and generally it's in the mid-size museum range. In other words, small museums, better college and university art galleries, all the way up to larger museums. We just booked one of our clients a show at the Butler Institute of American Art in Ohio, so we consider that to be a much more serious museum.
And right now you have a show on view at the BCB Gallery in Hudson, BCB Art.
Yes.
Is that also something you commonly do, is arrange shows with commercial galleries?
A little less commonly than working in the nonprofit sector. It's something that I like to do, but generally I do really prefer to work, with exposure that's gained for my clients through the nonprofit venues. It's much more difficult to get affiliations with better galleries if you have not had exhibitions in nonprofit institutions and built a more serious track record in that manner.
So that's the sort of thing that the galleries will really pay attention to.
Well, I think it really gives a dealer confidence, because generally through these exhibitions, artists are reviewed. It certainly does increase the value of their work. And I just think the prestige of exhibiting, in a small to mid-sized museum is something very substantial. It gives a collector confidence as well. So we like to build that first, and then I would say the final tier of my work for my clients, then I move into the commercial sector because it's much more competitive, and if you don't have the track record to accompany, what the exhibition, it's going to be very difficult to make sales.
the artist must have some kind of resume before they come and see you in order to get those shows, right?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, we work with, you know, artists at different levels of development, certainly. But, you know, we like to work primarily with artists that are mid-career, and that can be anywhere from, I would say, maybe their early 40s up until, you know, 60s or sometimes even older, and they've built a track record either locally or regionally. But I like to weigh that also with the quality of the work. I believe some artists are a little bit more uncertain and timid about exhibiting their work, but they've spent years in their studios really developing a serious body of work. So sometimes work is so exceptional that I'll really overlook a sort of preliminary or prerequisite track record in favor of just my really belief and commitment to the work and feeling that I have a chance of getting the shows even without a track record.
For the most part, do people come to you or do you seek out artists?
Well, when I was building the company, I did seek out artists, but I had made a lot of contacts across the country through my national lecture series, which was called The Highlights of the New York Art Season. So I traveled the country for about a decade and probably gave about 1,000 public lectures, so I met a lot of people.
So this was before you ever started the company.
Yes, that's right.
I
and so I made a lot of wonderful, you know, contacts. So initially people knew about me through my lecture series, and then I sort of evolved the lecture series into professional development seminars. So I started meeting artists that were really seeking someone that could advise them and help them make inroads into, you know, the more serious art world.
How did you come to do the lectures?
Well, it was after when I lost the use of my arms, I thought, well, what am I going to do? I'd had a wonderful career in New York for over a decade, and it had 4 or 5 reviews in the New York Times and Arts Magazine, and I was really going great guns. I'd shown at the New Museum in New York and PS1, and things looked very good. And then I was in that you know, automobile accident. And when I was trying to think of what I was going to do now that I couldn't paint anymore, it occurred to me that getting information of what is hot and what is not in New York very, very quickly to do these large surveys actually might be something that would be very interesting to the college and university art departments. So I started on a mission to see 200 to 300 shows a year in New York, and then I would collect the 50 or 60 artists' works that I really thought were the most exciting and would be the most interesting to talk about and that I personally felt was really significant work. And so that's kind of what got me started in that process. But it caught on, much to my surprise, and one thing led to another.
What kind of work were you doing yourself when you were painting?
Well, I was really a minimal abstractionist. But my first show in New York, I was doing much more abstract work, and then as the years went on, you know, the work became much more reductive and hard-edged. So it was a little bit difficult when you couldn't use your arms other than strapping them to your body and having your paintings on a Lazy Susan device. That got pretty tedious very quickly.
You were always interested in every kind of art, however.
I always was interested in art. Yes, I was. And I couldn't imagine myself being in another field, but I'd only been trained to be a studio artist. So I think the fact that I had some wonderful breaks early on in my career and some people in New York recognized, you know, my talent. And I think because I had some breaks that I felt like I might be in a position to sort of get artists started in the right direction. So that's kind of how that came about.
And so the artists then enter into a contract with you.
Yes, they do.
And how does all that work?
Well, an artist generally, in the beginning, I used to do 3-year contracts, but now my contracts are 18 months. And during that 18-month period, the initial thing that we do is, of course, prepare all the marketing materials for our clients. I've probably gotten, of all the exhibitions I've booked, probably 90% have been, you know, secured through the use of the marketing catalogs and brochures that the company uses. And Bill Zimmer was really the first person to sort of throw his weight to me. And of course, that opened many doors for me professionally. But he used to write the essays in the initial years. and we would send the catalogs out, and then things really started heating up. You know, people were interested in the fact that our exhibitions were rental-free, and that they came with 200 complimentary catalogs, and that I provided 1,000 color announcement cards for my clients. And the fact that we put together a package that made us really competitive in the field by offering these wonderful components with our exhibitions, but not charging any rental fee, it really sort of like brought us, you know, into the lead in terms of this kind of placement of work. Because a lot of small to mid-sized institutions may be doing extremely serious programming, but they may be simultaneously working with a very, very limited budget. So when they can get a beautiful color catalog, you know, with an essay by a leading New York critic, and then we help them with all the written materials and support for the exhibition, I think that's very appealing. And I think without my associates, I don't think I'd be sitting here today.
Do you have certain venues that you've worked with again and again?
Yes, I do. I have a number of venues that have maybe taken as many as 30 shows. So you start to develop relationships. It's always like a terrible blow when somebody retires. But if they move on to a new institution, you just sort of bird dog them to the next place and hope that you can talk them into, you know, taking the exhibitions. But I wanted to kind of go back to BCB for just a moment, because we were sort of talking about, I think, in terms of Brenda Giegerich and Sandra Gottlieb. I mean, both of these women artists are very strong, and we've been able to get them exhibitions around the country. But I think that after quite a number of years of having success in the nonprofit area, artists are really seeking to make some gallery affiliations. And so with regard to the two artists that really Bruce selected, I think he made excellent choices, because these artists work, it's very mature work. I think these artists are seasoned professionals. You know, I think they can also be an asset in this process with Bruce. And I think it's just a wonderful sort of final step to try to get artists placed into different commercial venues, with the hopes that, you know, that they'll start to sell work and build a much bigger collecting base. So, you know, I mean, I think Bruce really showed that he has an excellent I think this work is very, you could live with it very, very easily. It's quite beautiful and seductive. So for me, I mean, that was really exciting to get to work with one of my professional colleagues, you know, in the county that I, you know, live. And this is the kind of thing that everything in my life has always been based on the relationships that I've cultivated.
Just to let people know what we're talking about a little bit, the one artist does these beautiful photographs where she wades out into the water at Rockaway Beach and gets the most amazing color.
Yeah, it's just phenomenal. It's like they almost become sculptural, three-dimensional. At once, they look like a painting, you know, almost a piece of sculpture, like there's a three-dimensional sort of water bubble floating on the surface while it's photography. And 16 years of sort of hammering away at the same subject, you get pretty darn good at what you're doing.
So. You know what you're looking at. And the other artist makes monotypes.
Yes, Brenda Giegerich, she actually started out as she really does still paint, but her paintings were very, very colorful landscapes, but they had the quality almost of a stained glass window. There was something very fauvist and very immediate about the way that she, you know, applies her paint, and I always loved that animated quality. But then she was sort of simultaneously, you know, creating these monoprints, and the monoprints always seemed to have a much lighter hand than the paintings did, and these have become much more sort of ephemeral, and they're really these beautiful interpretations of the landscape that almost have a kind of zen quality to them. So, you know, I think Bruce couldn't have chosen a better pairing with these two artists.
So these artists, they enter into a contract with you. They give you a certain amount of money to manage this
Yes, it averages about $12,000 a year, and that includes the production of a catalog, the production of all the written pieces. We do written support pieces for the PDF presentation that we often will send links to the different museums after we've sent catalogs. We produce all the written press materials for the museums. Then we do the catalog essay. And then we design the catalog. And then we do a wallet CD. And the CD actually fits into this beautiful wallet presentation, and it contains the PDF of everything that we're offering for the exhibition, and then sort of a short introductory essay about the artist's work, and then an artist statement, a biographical summary, that sort of thing, so that the museum can be quickly and easily introduced to the artist's work. They can share that with their colleagues as they're reaching a decision in committee, whatever their particular process is. I've always really felt having these visual supports was, it was essential, you know, to having our artists selected, because we are, you know, submitting our things along with every other, you know, artist who is trying to get an exhibition, or gallery that is trying to get an exhibition for their artists. We're in that same, you know, large grouping when these committees meet. So I've always tried to give everything to someone that, you know, is really required to reach a decision. So they sign the contract. So we go through about this, I'd say, about a three-month period of producing all the written materials, producing the catalog, producing the PDF, and kind of concurrent to that, I am doing all the research for what I believe the best possible venues for their work and who I'm going to approach. Now, we work in different levels. A level one museum would be a museum that had, or a better college and university art gallery or art center, they may have anywhere from 5,000 to 20,000 in annual attendance. Many of these are small jewel-like museums, and they're all over the country, which I think when the artist actually, when I explain to them how I go about doing all of this research, you know, they're really amazed to see how many opportunities exist for them that they really weren't aware of before. So we start out, if an artist has, say, you know, a local or maybe a statewide track record, and we're trying to take them, you know, into a new region, what we'll do is we'll do all the research for that particular, you know, region in a level one and a level two. Because the way it works in the museum world is that you have to get your first one-person museum show before everybody, you know, before other people, I should say, certainly not everybody, but before other people will start to look at you more seriously. So you have to begin at level one, and then you might try a little bit larger museum or come back into that area and then resend the materials and indicate to the curators that you've been able to, you know, book an exhibition at such and such museum. And then that kind of momentum builds credibility, and then people start to pay attention, which is, you know, it's just like, I don't think that sometimes people think as independently as I would, as we would all hope or I would like for them to do. Sometimes if their colleagues haven't sort of given, you know, the work a stamp, the stamp of approval, sometimes they're a little hesitant to sort of stick their neck out if somebody hasn't got, you know, a pretty substantial track record. So I try to build credibility through the exhibitions that I get, and as the years go on, I'll move through to level two, and those are museums that usually have between about 30,000 and 100,000 in annual attendance, and then I'll move up to level three, and those are the much larger museums and museums that have a much more significant reputation. And that sort of, and that happens over a period of time. It can't happen overnight. So I'm always hoping my artists will really stick with me, because the longer they stick with me, the greater the chance that I'll be able to really achieve something important for them.
Now, there's a certain amount of work that the artist himself has to do before he can really be helped in any way by you, right?
Yes. I mean, they've got to have a great body of work. I mean, that's kind of what the whole initial process is. Everything in my company begins with a consultation, and it's a one-on-one with me, so I can look at somebody in their eyes, you know, and get a sense of what they're all about and how committed they are, you know, to this and to the whole process of being a professional artist, certainly, but, you know, taking their work into consideration, that is the most important component. You know, do they have the work there? Do they have enough work? And is it going to really make for a cohesive, I think, strongly thematically linked exhibition? And is it going to meet certain curatorial standards to actually be considered? So you have to at least be, you know, at that point. So that would be a kind of a minimal requirement. If the work, you know, is not there, I just can't do it. I mean, I'm happy to advise them and help them through without being under contract through many a la carte services that we can offer in my ongoing consultation advisement. I offer those things, but in the final analysis, everything is predicated on the work.
Now, you also offer quite a lot of advice free of charge in your book.
I do, and thank you for bringing that up.
Now, that's called Accelerating on the Curves, The Artist's Roadmap to Success.
Yes.
This was published a couple of years ago, I think.
Yes, it was. It was the hardest thing I ever did in my entire life. I'm not a writer. You know, I'm a good telephone talker and promoter. So, actually, you know, I only wrote about a third of the book. I had 22 other people contribute to the effort, and what I think we came up with was the best that we all had to offer in the area of advising artists how to be more effective at promoting their work. I never really felt that just because I'd come up with a particular technique or style of approach at what I do that I should kind of hide those things or make them, you know, secret. I don't really believe that it's, you know, I think a lot of fingers in the pie is just fine. So we wanted to share everything we knew. And so for $99 at runninghairpress.com, you can get about a 360-page book that tells all the secrets, all the stories, and that also my very distinguished and luminary art world associates also share their point of view on the subject as well. So,
and this is something that, for the most part, is really not taught in the art schools, right?
No, it's not. You know, that then I can really get on a I really, you know, don't like that. I mean, I feel that this is something that is part of the real world, and I think, although I really believe this whole process of identifying your unique voice and being able to, you know, to be able to access that information where your work is concerned, I think, of course, that's paramount. It's the most important thing. However, you have to balance everything out, and you have to give them real-world, you know, advice. And this advice has to be able to teach them how to start to build an exhibition record and to have a serious career so that maybe ultimately someday they can make a living or a partial living from the sale of their work, or they can have a serious career, you know, just with very fine exhibits. If you can't give students that, in my personal opinion, I think that it's remiss, it's not fair, and they really need to be doing this. So,
and I think you've said in a sense the teachers may feel some competition from the students.
Well, I mean, I really do believe that sometimes that is the case. But, I think that's in some ways it's human nature, because when everything that you have has been so hard fought and hard won, sometimes you're less, you know, willing to share that crucial information with people because you went through so much to get it. But actually, I don't think that the forces of the universe work like that. I think the more that you're willing to share and help other people along, I think the more that you're helped. And I don't think sometimes we can even know what the ultimate payoff is for something like that. So
now, I don't know if you know, Bruce represents an artist named Lucio Pozzi.
Oh, yes,
Lucio always says, emulation, not competition.
Yeah,
this is how it should be an artist, playing off each other, working together, rather than constantly vying.
I think that's really so true. You know, I mean, it's unfortunate when people are competitive with one another. When, you know, joining forces, you know, you're really a lot stronger in sharing information and, you know, guiding people. It comes back to you tenfold. It's unfortunate that more people in the art world don't kind of get it. So,
now, when you go to museums out in other parts of the country, are they subject to the whims and fashions of the New York art world?
Well, I mean, I think that is really such a good question. I think, you know, this is such a big country, and I think maybe sometimes the further you get away from New York and L.A., I think that people, it may not be that they're more conservative. It just may mean that they want more sort of evidence of, you know, skill, ability, maturity in the work. I think that, you know, it's a much more grounded, realistic kind of area to operate in. And because, you know, many of my artists are strong representational, you know, painters. I have less conceptual artists than I do, you know, photographers or, you know, painters, that kind of thing. So, you know, it's the kind of thing that, you know, I really feel that as you go out into the, you know, the great sort of wheatlands of the United States. I just think a lot of people really appreciate that, and you know, appreciate the work that you're showing, and are a little bit more open to giving people an opportunity, a chance, when it's so, so competitive, you know, in New York and L.A.
What brought you to Columbia County?
Well, you know, I'd been in New York for about 15 years in the New York area, New Jersey, and then I decided I would go back to Florida. And I think I went back to Florida because, you know, it's like you kind of go full circle in life, and I kind of maybe needed to take care of some business down there. And then once I had done it, I realized I really need to get the hell out of there and come back up to New York. And so I had a friend here in Hudson who had a store called Shop Naked. His name was Henry Auvel, and Henry said,
yes.
Catherine, I think you can get, I didn't want to go back to the city. He said, I think you can really get a wonderful piece of property that's large enough to have all your offices in Columbia County, and you'll be able to afford it. So I looked for 3 years, and I found it, and, you know, and that, and it's worked out just fine.
I wonder if there was more than one William Zimmer. I had a friend. He'd worked with Bob Wilson. Uh-huh. His name was Mel Andringa.
Uh-huh.
And he did performance pieces. He did one time where he put a blindfold on a William Zimmer,
uh-huh,
to show that you could make a drawing without looking.
Oh, he did? I wonder if that was Bill. But, you know, Bill would have been game for that. He was very, very open and very supportive of artists, and he, uh-huh, would have been the adventuresome sort that would have submitted to something like that.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know, though. Well, once Bill Zimmer joined me, at that time, you know, he was had been writing for the New York Times for many, many years. Once he joined me, I think that he had such a, you know, a wonderful reputation that when, you know, they saw that somebody of that caliber really believed in the concept of the company, you know, then I started, you know, hearing from different critics. But the way that I started was, is I went back to critics in New York who had reviewed my work when I was a painter. So, you know, I started with Peter Frank, who had reviewed my work when I had a show at the New Museum, and, you know, from there I went to Robert Mahoney, who had reviewed my work in Arts Magazine, and the people that had been supportive of my efforts as an artist, I thought, well, that would be the most ideal person to, you know, approach and see if I could interest them, you know, in the idea. So then Peter Frank joined me and Robert Mahoney, and then this sort of like wonderful, you know, group of people, you know, started approaching me, and then it just, you know, it's just really, it's magic. I don't even know how I happen to be sitting here. Things have turned out so well. But,
Now, do you still work as intensively at this as you did?
I do, but in a different way. You know, it's like when I was much younger, you know, I could probably carry as many as 40 or 50 artists. But now I like to keep between about 25 to 30, you know, artists. I think things that, it's just sort of like trimming the fat away, refining as you go along. I think there's certain things that I'm, you know, not inclined to do anymore. I don't think it's as efficient or as effective. And so it's just, it's like anything that you work on for so many years and that is sort of like your baby, your creation. You just, it's just like artists, you get better and better at it if you really stay with it. And I feel like that's kind of what's happened to me and my company. I just think that you know, I've kind of got a template that works, and I keep refining that template. So, you know, of course you don't have the same stamina you did when you were 25, 30 years old, but I think that, you know, I'm working very consistently, and I'm booking more shows now than I've ever booked in my life. So, I mean, it's like that's the big payoff. I hung in there.
Uh-huh. So, do you interact with the artists regularly?
They always ask me that in consultation, you know, will I be able to call you and talk to you and have that? And I go, well, I want to be perfectly honest with you. This 3-hour meeting is probably as intense as it's ever going to be in terms of our communication and my answering questions. You know, it's like when you have an exhibition or anything that's related to work that the company is doing, yes, you know, I will talk with you, but I can't have sort of informal, you know, sort of like easy access all the time, or it's like it's me. I'm the one that's making 80 to 100 telephone calls to these institutions to book the exhibitions, and I usually make 80 to 100 calls for every one show that I book. So since I'm virtually alone with some assistance from Robert Curcio in New York and another woman in the office that I have, I'm virtually doing most everything. So, you know, I can't just chat along. As much as I'd love to know some of these people personally and, you know, meet them for a drink and hang out, it's just not feasible. So,
When you say 80 to 100 calls, that's to one particular institution, or that would be to several?
For every 1 to 2 exhibitions I book, I have contacted between 80 and 100 institutions. That's how competitive this business is, and the kind of stamina you have, the willingness to keep getting shot down again and again. But all it takes is just the one, and then the one leads to the next one, so you kind of have to just keep on keeping on. So,
I think it was Jack Yates, painter, who said, history will judge who were the good artists. All we know is there are too many of us.
Oh, how accurate that is. I know. It's like they keep, just turning these people out of the art schools. You know, you really feel so bad in so many ways because, you know, there's so few, you know, galleries. I mean, it may be in New York, you know, 300 to 400, maybe less than a quarter of those. A lot of people would even want to be affiliated, you know, with, in terms of the type of work that they're doing. So, and 120,000 artists in the greater metropolitan area.
Is that right?
Yeah. And so you're just talking about, it's a really, really tough business. So, you know, it's like, I think to keep turning these people out without giving them some other way to, you know, butter their bread. I mean, there's a real degree of lack of responsibility, I think. You know, a lot of these schools charge a great deal of money, and I think they're not prepared when they come out, sadly. But that's my soapbox thing. I won't get going on that.
do people take out the same kind of student loans for art school as anywhere else, I suppose? Huh?
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm not really sure if that kind of money is still available. But, I mean, some of these graduate schools, you know, are like $80,000 a year. I mean, it's no... Oh. I mean, it would even give me pause now if I were going back to school and wanted to get my graduate degree. I mean, that's a lot of money and a lot of years paying that back. So, you know, I mean, that's why I think it's so critical that these schools become more active, in many ways maybe even playing a role that's similar to mine, you know, helping them, you know, identify the exhibition opportunities, you know, in their state and region, telling them how to begin that process, giving them the advice to, you know, to be able to do the proper research and identify the right sort of marriages for their work. I mean, that should really be a part of it. They shouldn't come out of school empty-handed with just a piece of paper. That I don't get. I really don't get. So.
Yeah, it seems that the colleges do have a sort of placement office for other things, right, for teachers and things.
Well, they do. They do. And, I mean, I'm sure there's some colleges that are doing a wonderful job, you know, but I think as a general rule, you know, they sort of look at the time that you spend in school is as a period of time where it's really developing, you know, your ideas and giving some, you know, validity to what you're doing, being able to articulate the ideas that surround the work, and then ultimately having some sort of a body of work. I mean, they are hopefully doing that, at least that. But, you know, I really think there's a lot more to it.
Now, as far as an art market, there's New York and there's Los Angeles.
Chicago. Oh, there's all kinds of places. I mean, yes. You know, it's like when you get those big books, the American Art Directory and the Official Museum Directory, which are really my Bibles. When you get big books like that in your hands, you know, you can see what there is in Dallas, Houston, you know, Memphis, Charlotte, Atlanta. I mean, it's just the country has got a lot of wonderful, you know, museums. And not only that, it's like they have these wonderful, like Marfa in Texas. I mean, they have these places that are so isolated but are so extraordinary because the quality of the programming is off the charts fabulous. So, you know, just to think it always even has to happen in a big city, I mean, there are some very sophisticated audiences, some incredibly well-funded museums, and they're not in your, like, top 40, you know, American cities. So, you know, these artists ought to get these two books, and it'll just sort of be like an oyster opening up with all kinds of pearls. So, pearls of possibility.
Those directories you mention in your book.
They're all in the book. Yeah, I tell you how to go about identifying, you know, the size of the museum and what to look for. You know, they tell you what's in their collection, which becomes part of my research, because if I think there's a historical collection that could connect to one of my artists, then I'll approach a museum on that basis, you know, not just on who's shown there in the past, but if I can somehow link with their permanent collection, that's yet again another angle, you know, for approach that could really work. So, Yeah, you get a lot of information out of those books. You find out whether they take traveling, you know, exhibitions, and that's really, for me, that's a critical bit of information. I find out how big the exhibition spaces are, the size of their audiences, you know, and then you have to go to the website, and sometimes the websites are not so sophisticated, and then you may think, oh, I don't know if that's really going to help my client's career. I got to take a closer look at this, you know, as to whether I'm going to make that part of my, you know, final research list.
Now, the web must have made your work a lot easier.
It did. It really did. You know, I mean, now we can really find out an awful lot, you know, in addition to using the books. But the books are still the anchors, the rocks. And we only go to the websites after we've really identified something in the book. But this is a really interesting thing. You know, it's like everybody, you know, all this whole social media thing, you know, doing all of these things on the Internet. I want you to know that out of the between 400 and 500 museums that have said they'll take a look at what we have to offer, that we have about 15 names on our digital list, meaning that these museums still like to get a catalog and the supportive material. They want to be seduced. They want to hold it in their hands. And only 15 have said, please just send us links. Just send us, you know. So, you know, it's like, so we're still at a 1% to 2%, even with social media. So you got to somehow balance those things because, you know, just sending out all these things, it's so easy to delete you. And but when they get something physically in their hands, it can make it really decisive.
Yeah,
they
have an attractive catalog. It's a completely different thing.
That's a great investment for an artist. A great investment is a really nice catalog.
And you always do that as part of the
original package.
Yes.
Uh-huh. We make sure they have everything they need to, you know, to get those exhibition bookings. So.
How long did you spend writing the book? That must have been,
God, it's almost 10 years, I have to confess.
Is that right? Yeah,
yeah, for just like, you know, my like 100 pages. I mean, you would think that it was like, you know, trial by fire. I just kept, you know, I started out doing it all by tape because I was a professional speaker and gave seminars. I did hours and hours of in-studio recording, that sort of thing. And then I decided that I didn't want to do that because the information was too detailed. And then following that, we then transcribed all the tapes, and then I had to go back in, you know, and like, and then finally I just threw it all out, and I said, okay, after wasting 4 or 5 years doing this, I think I'm just going to sit down and try to write this thing. So it was a real process for me, but of course the associates turned everything around to me in a matter of like 30 to 60 days, where I'd agonized for years.
You must have been collecting some of these quotations for some time also.
Oh, I'm a big quote person. Uh-huh. I love quotes. You know, uh-huh. I just think they're inspiring. They somehow, they give you the courage to keep, you know, persevering and to conduct your life with integrity and valor. And so I'm a big quote person.
Well, I enjoyed them.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad.
God is love, but get it in writing.
Oh, God. Isn't that the truth?
Gypsy Rose Lee.
I know. That is so true. I mean, it's just like, as so many artists think, because somebody says they're going to give them, you know, an exhibition, and they make a verbal promise that is not a contract. That is not, you know, the specified arrangements of an exhibition. And I've seen artists disappointed again and again because everything was sort of like a verbal agreement, or it was very loose. But, you know, you got to have a contract, and everybody's responsibilities have to be specified in that contract, or, you know, you're going to have trouble, and you want to avoid trouble. You really do.
Do you kind of make the rounds of local galleries?
I do. I mean, I'm so glad that I live near Hudson. I used to spend much more time in New York, you know, because I was flying back and forth from Florida every couple of months, staying in the Algonquin once I gave up my apartment. So I was in New York all the time when I was living in Florida. And now that I'm in Hudson, I go to New York less than I did when I was in Florida.
Is that right?
And it's a funny thing because I couldn't do it all. So I could either be on top of everything that's happening nationally in the nonprofit sector, or I had to turn things over to the associates and really let their domain be New York. So I rely heavily on them to sort of advise me when we're making, you know, lists for artists to approach different galleries on their behalf. I really rely on my associates to provide me with their recommendations, and then I act on those recommendations, because there's no way I could, you know, do everything that I'm doing and then still stay on top of the New York art scene like I did when I was, you know, had my national lecture series. I had to make a choice. So I have a great group of, you know, people who, you know, handle sort of like the New York end of things, where, you know, I'm trying to go all over the country. So, yeah.
I'm sure we're lucky to have you in the area.
Oh, well, that's so nice of you. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Richard Roth, and I'm here with Harold Hansen at Verso, versofinearts.com, 530 Warren Street in Hudson. Harold has been a presence on Warren Street for quite some years by now. Welcome, Harold. You were saying something about the kind of people who come to Hudson.
I'm always intrigued when I talk with people, as I endeavor to do whenever people visit my shop. And I always try to ask people where they're coming from. And I'm perhaps in any given day or any given week, maybe half the people that visit my shop and presumably other shops in Hudson, more than half the people are from out of town, often people from Europe, often people, like a few minutes ago, a woman from Australia. Hudson's, for a city, a small city of 7,000, we attract a remarkable number of people from across the world, in addition to just people from New York City.
Now, is that something that's changed in the last few years, or was it kind of always that way since the antique business?
Since I opened the shop 2 years ago, it sort of seems to be, I would imagine it's been that way now for the last 10 or 15 years of Hudson's renewal.
And it was the antiques trade that brought them here primarily.
Principally antiques, and also now the presence of Stair Galleries as an auction gallery that attracts kind of national attention. But I think people are also attracted to the fact that we have so many fine restaurants now in Hudson, and I think that's sort of a magnet for people.
What brought you here when you first came?
Well, that's a long time ago, Richard. That goes back to 1986. At that time, I accepted an invitation for dinner by someone that had just purchased a home in Hudson in 1986. And this is what I think is the interesting analogy. At that time, Hudson was half empty. And now it's sort of half full. And what I am alluding to is that Hudson, way back in 1986, was in pretty bad shape. There were lots of commercial vacancies, a lot of apartment vacancies. The town's history had largely been obscured by whatever happened in America in the 1960s and 70s. And then with the restoration of Hudson, that began perhaps in the late 80s, the late 1980s, and all the shops that have opened and the art galleries that have opened, bed and breakfasts that have opened, restaurants, the city's really come to life. But we almost have to be reminded that at the time of the American Civil War, Hudson had as many as 15,000, 16,000 residents. So when I say half empty, what I would like to say now is half full, meaning Hudson's regained its momentum as an important city to visit.
Now, has the population actually increased, or it's just that sort of people who were doing things and starting shops and so on moved in?
Well, I don't think that the population actually in the last 10 years has probably declined. I think I remember back in the 90s the population was around 8,000 and now it's 7,000. But I think you have so many visitors and so many people that live in the outskirts of Hudson or in Greene County that have businesses here in Hudson that the city is very thriving, which is always very evident every weekend.
And even during the week, it seems as though the parking spaces are full on most of Warren Street.
And I think you're right, Richard. And today, as an example, on a Thursday, which would normally be a quiet day in Hudson, I've had nonstop traffic all day since I opened before 11 o'clock. And I've had the same cross-section of people from Boston, people from Salem, Massachusetts, a woman that was just here from Australia, and often people from neighboring counties, Dutchess County. So it's a real cross blending of people.
Do you stay open every day?
I open 5 days a week, every day except Tuesday and Wednesday. And apparently, I subscribe. There's a business discussion group online where people, where merchants can talk to each other. And Jennifer Ehrenskode mentioned that a lot of people were in Hudson just yesterday on a Wednesday, normally the day that most shops in Hudson are closed. People are coming every day.
And they're serious shoppers?
Well, I think to some extent you could say people are browsers, but how can you be a buyer unless you're also a browser? So even if people don't purchase the first time they visit you, on the assumption that they enjoyed the experience and will want to come back, that presumably at some future date they will be a customer. So we have to be as welcoming as we can be to all the people that come and visit our shops. I would like to tell you about one situation that arose. Perhaps about a year ago, a couple in their early 30s, a man and woman, came into the shop and they told me they were from Australia. And they were coming to me just after, apparently, the husband was of English descent and had, his family were of English descent, even though he was now Australian. The woman was an Australian of American descent, and apparently she was trying to conduct research, and she established that her family, she had some historical information that her family were from the rural hamlet of Kiskaton in Greene County. And apparently the day before they came into the shop, they had gone in search of anything in the anything that they could find, and they were able to find the burial sites of her forebears that date back to around 1830. So then you have to ask yourself, how did a family living in Kiskaton decide to move to Australia back in 1830? And so we had a very pleasant encounter. And so I was asking them about their life in southern Australia. And they explained to me that they had a 30,000-acre farm between Melbourne and Sydney. 30,000 acres. They just struck me as being a very interesting couple. My observation about people as they come into your shop, people always have something interesting to say about themselves if you just scratch the surface and just engage people in conversation on the assumption that they're interested in carrying a conversation, and most people are. And so I always encourage anyone who works with me, always talk to people. Try to identify who people are and try to identify what their interests are. And in that way you can respond. There might be something you have in your shop that they would take an interest in. Hi. Please look around.
Hi.